Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, June 22nd. I'm your reader, Bob Young. Our first article from the front page is Virus Tests Technology and opens with a picture of workers putting that orange conduit into a hole in the ground that had been drilled. Des Moines. While Iowans aren't exactly zooming through the coronavirus pandemic, there's no question technology has been the linchpin for many to weather the disruptions, isolation, and life changes that are insidious and novel as the virus itself. Internet usage in Iowa has surged since COVID-19 arrived in the state and a national emergency was declared in March. Iowans are downloading and uploading data at a significantly higher rate in a new normal requiring them to work, learn, shop, and seek medical help from home to avoid large gatherings and maintain safe distances necessary to slow the viral spread. But issues of quality, speed, availability, reliability, and cost have underscored inequities that digitally divide Iowans and raise concerns over ensuring access to anyone who wants or needs to traverse the information superhighway. Similar to the way electricity and other technological advances became an essential element of society, I think access across the country, people have really woken up to the idea that the internet is no longer just a luxury that we watch Netflix on, said Tyler Cooper, editor-in-chief of Broadband Now, a nonprofit company that tracks data on 2,665 internet providers in the United States market. It's really a prerequisite for so many aspects of modern living, and I think that it has done a lot to shift the public perception on broadband access as well, especially in rural areas. By necessity, Iowans of all ages are reshaping the way they do things and becoming much more electronic device reliant as they find new methods to perform old tasks or forge new models for doing businesses, getting educated, meeting people, and conducting commerce in a period of societal transition that is challenging, exciting, and scary. There's no going back, said Brian Waller, president of the Technology Association of Iowa, a consortium of 350 tech companies that is leading celebrations this week, hailing innovation during the June 22nd through 26th period that Governor Kim Reynolds has proclaimed as Technology Week in Iowa. Quote, we're not going back to the way things were, Waller said, saying that he has been really in awe with the way that Iowans, businesses, institutions, nonprofits, professionals, and most aspects of daily life have used creativity, nimbleness, and innovation to adapt to changing realities brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. I think this is a big transition, but I think it's going to be for the better. I think it's going to be pretty special when we come out of this, Waller said. I think this is something special that we're going to get through, but we're all a little nervous. The successes and setbacks, the pluses and minuses of life in semi-quarantine over the past few months are incredibly etched in the minds of Iowans who lived through it. But the future still holds opportunities and much uncertainty regarding the possible coronavirus resurgence, the continuing build-out of Iowa's internet capabilities, the real-life or virtual classrooms, the evolving work settings, and so much more. Iowans and their technological skills have been put to the test as companies and employees move their workplaces online. Healthcare providers rely on telehealth to connect with patients. People use internet to apply for resources, seek assistance, or purchase necessities. Teachers and students use broadband to connect, and devices help families keep in touch with friends and loved ones. We've all learned to use Zoom to do everything from catching up with our grandkids to conduct local board of adjustment meetings, Reynolds told Iowans last week. Education, healthcare, and so many other sectors of our economy were forced almost overnight to innovate and adapt to survive. Officials with the State Department of Education have set a deadline this week for survey responses from administrators at Iowa's 337 school districts, detailing technology availability and challenges facing their districts as educators make plans on how to best deliver instruction beginning in August. Also, officials in the Reynolds administration are working through details for expanding internet and technology capabilities by way of a new round of grants and other vehicles for using at least $85 million in Federal CARES Act money to meet needs in Iowa's unserved and underserved rural and smaller communities. Along with that, the Federal Communications Commission has announced a Rural Digital Opportunity Fund aimed at spurring more rapid deployment of broadband networks to unserved Americans that looks to commit up to $20.4 billion over the next decade to support up to gigabit speed band broadband networks in rural areas. Dave Duncan, Chief Operating Officer of the Iowa Communications Alliance, a group of more than 130 telecommunications providers who offer broadband, telephone, and digital television service to rural Iowans, said his members are awaiting the rules application processes and other details for new government public works offerings. But in the meantime, they are still in the process of building out the state's internet capabilities. Alliance officials also have enlisted engineers to conduct a first-of-its-kind study into how much of Iowa currently is unserved by broadband and how much it would cost to build out future-proof fiber networks to all of Iowa so that at least we have a big-picture number. He said he hopes results would be available by July. As far as I know right now, there is no such estimate on what it costs and what the scope of unserved Iowa is right now, Duncan noted. It's not going to be the answer, but it's going to frame the issue and what public policy and private initiatives need to be. In internet-challenged areas, Iowans have faced new issues as parents and children compete for bandwidth to meet their work-at-home obligations and complete homework assignments over multiple devices. Some work-from-home Iowans, such as Bruce Treaton of rural Linn County, have had to adapt to new realities of making the best of a DSL internet. The connection loses issues, logging in to the company network, the laptop reboots, the slow app responses, and challenges downloading and uploading files. Quote, my working from home environment is sitting on a love seat with a laptop sitting on my lap and a mouse pad on the arm of the love seat. I call in for online meetings using my cell phone for audio, Tweeten said in an email. When possible, which is about 25% of the time, he completes his tasks by leaving home and going to his job site to stream multiple remote video connections or to use high bandwidth applications. Steve Purcell, a Mediacom Group president who oversees operations throughout most of Iowa, said his company saw a surge in upstream activity, which he attributed to more Iowans working from home. He said the higher usage has tailed off some since April's peak, but still is nearly 20% above normal. Quote, we've definitely seen an increase in overall usage with people working from home, noted Purcell, whose company has more than 400,000 Iowa customers in 309 communities and a network that potentially could reach 1 million homes. Likewise, Steve Hill of the Satellite Broadcasting and Communications Association said there has been a surge of interest among Iowa customers in satellite as a technology that can be delivered anywhere without having to wait for infrastructure. With COVID-19, we've been very busy, both with installations and customers increasing their data plans because they're doing more from home, Hill said. However, Dave Peters, an Iowa State University Associate Professor of Sociology and an extension rural sociologist, said finances must factor into the equation as well. You can get good internet service, but it costs money, and not everyone has that kind of money, he noted. And not all regions of the state have high-speed broadband connections. further exacerbating the digital divide and limiting Iowans' ability to telecommute or access telehealth services remotely. Quote, people saw this as more of a recreational divide than an essential divide, said Peters. But the coronavirus pandemic has really highlighted that when things like this happen, and we have the ability to move things online and do things like education, then it becomes a huge equity issue. If you're going to move instruction online, then that internet connection becomes almost like a public utility. It's a needed resource, not a luxury item, unquote. Mark Lane, superintendent of the Decorah Community School District, a district with about 1,700 students in rural northeast Iowa, where the hills, valleys, and even cornfields pose a challenge for delivering internet service, told a recent online congressional roundtable organized by U.S. Representative Abby Fickenauer, Democrat from Dubuque, that staff and students in his system faced challenges in using their devices. To address internet inequalities, Lane said, the school board acted to install outdoor wireless antennas at the district's 5 campuses so students, weather permitting, could sit in the bleachers at the football field or at a picnic table at the playground of an elementary school to do their online assignments. Parents also indicated they were taking children to their workplaces to access the internet during off hours. Representative James Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina, the House Majority Whip, who has championed rural broadband expansion, told Fickenauer meeting he encountered similar stories of rural Americans telling him how the parents would come home from work each night, load their children in their cars, and drive to the local library that had already closed so they could sit in the parking lot to do their homework while tapping into the library's Wi-Fi. He also spoke of a rural Georgia high school football team's that would load students in school buses after practice and drive to local fast food restaurants to use the Wi-Fi to do their homework in the parking lot. That just got to me. This country should not allow that to happen, said Clyburn. Quote, we know now this pandemic is the best thing we could do today, or maybe the greatest thing, is to have broadband in every home. Like the electrification of America in the 1930s, he added, we ought to treat the information highway the same way we treat interstate highways. Cooper said a key challenge facing policymakers and industry leaders is the lack of unified strategy at the national level. There's no game plan to say this is the mixture of technologies that we're relying upon, or this is the roadmap to closing the digital divide, he noted. Waller said one outgrowth of the evolving workplace and the role of technology would be that people become, quote, a little more unchained from their office desks. He said the post-pandemic business world also may see companies moving away from bricks and mortar corporate settings, since there has not been a perceived drop-off in employee productivity under the new workplace models. Annie Zielinski, an associate dean at the University of Iowa, who has been involved in the teaching, technology, and distance and online learning areas, said rapid change was forced upon many aspects of education. She said some practices likely will change as a result of the COVID-19 experience, such as faculty using Zoom for office hours that are more convenient for students. But she expected the changes to be around the edges, while the overall mission of the university remains being a residential campus with a small but robust online presence. In our next article from the front page, study says COVID-19 most active in the nose. And the article opens with a picture of a man and a woman both wearing face masks, sitting on a park bench and having a conversation. Raleigh, North Carolina. One of the most confusing aspects of COVID-19 is its tendency to spread when people don't have symptoms. But a new study from researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill may explain why that happens and help doctors prevent the worst cases of the disease. The study found the coronavirus infects the cells in the nose much more easily than those in the throat and lungs. Scientists are still working to understand the ways people can catch COVID-19, an important clue to Dr. Richard Botcher of the senior researchers at the UNC School of Medicine, is that many people with coronavirus lose their sense of smell. Previous research suggests that over half of patients with COVID-19 partially or completely lost their sense of smell while sick. This suggested that coronavirus could be especially active in the nose, even when people don't show classic nasal symptoms like sneezing, runny nose, or congestion. As pulmonologist Botcher sees many people with chronic lung problems get sick when germs from the mouth or nose accidentally fall into the lungs with fluids like saliva or mucus. This could mean that instead of launching a direct assault on the lungs, the coronavirus camps out in the nose, building up and waiting for some lucky drips to carry it down the sinuses and throat. The UNC team compared how easily the coronavirus infects the cells lining different parts of the respiratory tract from the nose to the lungs. The cells in the nose turned out to be the easiest to infect, followed by cells in the throat, and then those in the lungs. This mostly matched up with the relative concentrations of a protein in our bodies that the coronavirus uses to get inside cells. The researchers also examined the lungs of people who had died from COVID-19. If they got the coronavirus directly from breathing it in the air, it would be evenly spread out in the lungs. You could expect the lung to look like it had one big veil of COVID-19 coming down over it, Botcher said. Instead, spots of severe infection were next to healthy tissue. This supports the theory that the lungs were infected when mucus and other liquids are aspirated into the lungs. If you get a teaspoon down the wrong way, it's going to go preferentially down a few airways, Botcher said. Most of the infected patches were in the lower lungs, another sign of a falling liquid. These findings matched with X-ray observations of COVID-19 patients showing more diseased patches lower in the lungs. The UNC study helps explain why it's so easy to spread COVID-19 even without showing symptoms, Botcher said. Your nose is used to filter out a lot of things and seeing a lot of things. It's the first line of defense and catches things like viruses in hair and mucus. You might feel fine if the coronavirus is only in your nose, but breathing or sneezing can send coronavirus particles into the air. Some people are more likely to aspirate fluid into their lungs, which can explain why certain groups are at higher risk for severe illnesses from COVID-19. As you get older, as you get chubbier, or if you have diabetes, Beecher said, the reflexes that prevent aspiration tend to be less effective. As a result, higher amounts of coronavirus get into the lungs where the most harmful symptoms develop. If the nose is where the coronavirus prepares to attack the rest of the body, we can fortify our nasal defenses to help it from gaining ground in the first place. Clinical trials are looking into whether rinses can flush the coronavirus out from the nose. The less virus, aspiration is less likely to infect the lungs. It may also be possible to trick the nose into thinking it's already under attack before a person is exposed to the coronavirus. This primes a broad immune response that can help fight off the viruses generally before the body is able to produce targeted defenses against COVID-19. Wearing a mask, even a non-medical one, blocks most large virus-carrying droplets that come out of the nose, like from a sneeze. And if the coronavirus is most likely to infect someone by getting into the nose, covering it makes the nose a harder target. Wearing masks really is a twofer, Beecher said. You're protecting yourself and you're protecting someone else from you transmitting something in an asymptomatic phase. This article was posted by the Associated Press. United Way invests $1.6 million in Cedar Valley community programs. Waterloo, Cedar Valley United Way officials announced $1,634,329 in investments in the Cedar Valley for the 2020-2021 funding year to support the community. This funding was made possible by gifts to Cedar Valley United Way's 2019 program. Of the investments, $1,559,329 was awarded in strategic investment grants to 64 community programs at 38 local nonprofits that address needs in the area of education, health, financial stability, and emergency and basic needs. Strategic investment grants were chosen by community impact team volunteers in each area who reviewed the applications as well as data addressing community needs to determine how United Way could make the largest impact with its community investment. In addition to aligning with the United Way's target areas, the primary goal in determining which organizations will be invested in is to identify those that are most effective at delivering results that make a measurable difference. Programs needed to show strong, accessible outcomes and an impact that has proven results in the community. After deciding which programs will be funded by United Way, community impact team volunteers evaluated how much financial support to give programs. The volunteers then focus on the targeted community needs of each funded program, the number of individuals in the program will serve, and how funds will advance the common good. A complete listing of the 64 programs receiving strategic investment grants is available at cedarvalleyunitedway.org/partners. Additional investments include the following: $50,000 in social innovation grants directed at breaking the cycle of systemic poverty. Social innovation grant applications will be reviewed per need, and recipients will be announced as the grants are awarded. Organizations interested in social innovation grant funding may contact Debbie Roth at debbie.roth@cvuw.org for more information. $25,000 with SuccessLink for a data management project to advance the development of a community-wide data system. $16,345 in designations to Cedar Valley United Way initiatives, including Books for Babies, Baby Safety Project, Mental Health Impact Work, and Women United. $20,600 for 211 information and referral services, a free and confidential hotline available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that connects people to human service and health resources in the community. $3,909 to United Way's Community Partner Fund to assist in responding to community needs as they arise. Previous investments in this area have included nonprofit board education and training disaster response and inclusion initiatives. $10,000 was invested in the Legacy Society Fund, which ensures United Way the ability to sustain programs, react to future crises, provide a cushion for tough economic times, provide tax benefits and savings, and honor to loved one or family members. $169,996 will be distributed in donor-directed designations to other 501c3 organizations as part of United Way's work to encourage charitable giving. Turning to the Cedar Valley section, Rowena Stevens played key role in women's suffrage. This is the 12th in a series of stories in 2020 about inspirational Iowa women in commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment allowing women to vote. Rowena Edson Stevens, born near Columbus, Wisconsin, in 1852, graduated from Iowa State College in its second class. She taught school in Iowa and Nebraska. In 1876, she married John Stevens, a graduate of Iowa State College's first class. The family lived in Ames and later in Boone. Stevens became socially and politically active, founding and supporting charitable organizations, as well as playing a prominent role in the struggle for women's suffrage. she organized the Political Equity Club in Ames, serving as its president. She held various offices in the Iowa Equal Suffrage Association, including president in 1894, in which capacity she addressed the Iowa legislature on behalf of the suffragist movement. A president of the Boone Equity Club, Stevens organized the first women's suffrage parade in the United States for the annual convention of the Iowa Equal Suffrage Association in Boone in 1908. Stevens was honored by the League of Women Voters in 1931 as one of the 24 women in Iowa whose courageous work opened the opportunities of complete citizenship to all women in the state. Stevens died in 1918. Stevens was inducted into the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame in 1995. Hy-Vee presents check to Northeast Iowa Food Bank, Waterloo. Hy-Vee Incorporated will present a check for more than $12,000 to the Northeast Iowa Food Bank, 1605 Lafayette Street, at 2 p.m. today. The check is part of the more than $1 million that was raised during Hy-Vee's company-wide campaign to help restock local food banks' shelves amid the coronavirus pandemic. From March 23 to May 31st, Hy-Vee customers within the food bank's region were encouraged to donate $1 or more at checkout or via Hy-Vee aisles online. Hy-Vee matched donations dollar for dollar up to $500,000 from the Hy-Vee One Step program, which is funded by proceeds from sales of select Hy-Vee products to assist those in need. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, June 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Today's paper does not have any obituaries listed, so let's turn to sports. Sports Briefs, Track and Field. The Track Guy Foundation is hosting a meet on July 7th in Brooklyn for athletes who just completed their 7th grade through senior year. Events include shot put, long jump, 100 and 110 hurdles, 400-meter dash, 100-meter dash, 200-meter dash, 2 and 400-meter hurdles, and the 1,600-meter high school boys run. Basketball. University of Iowa Women's Basketball Associate Head Coach Jan Jensen is one of five 2020 LGBTQ Legacy Leader Award honorees, Des Moines Magazine and One Iowa Leadership Institute announced on Thursday. The award is given to Iowans that make an impact in their communities and have persevered despite prejudice. Jensen earned the honor due to her involvement with the United Way of Johnson County, the Shelter House of Iowa City, and leadership and team-building speeches across the state. Auto racing. Thunderstorm Sunday forced NASCAR to postpone the Cup Series race at Talladega Super Speedway. That was to mark the return of more fans to the track. The race, which was pushed back to 2 p.m. today, is the first amid the coronavirus pandemic in which NASCAR opened the gates for up to 5,000 fans. Those in the grandstand were urged to seek shelter roughly 30 minutes before the scheduled start, leading to a 2-plus-hour wait. The addition of fans and the ban of Confederate flags weren't the only changes set to be on display in the race. NASCAR implemented new rules in response to Ryan Newman's harrowing accident when racing for the win on the final lap at Daytona in February. Changes include the elimination of aero ducts at speedway tracks, a reduction in size of throttle body, and requiring slip tape to be applied along the entire length of the lower rearward facing surfaces of the rear bumper cover. Iowa football. Actions make the difference. Iowa recruits now view football team under a new lens. Iowa City. Actions, not words, will likely dictate the long-term ramifications of how claims of racial disparity within the Iowa football program will impact the Hawkeyes. Iowa has secured verbal commitments from the majority of the scholarships it has available for the 2021 recruiting class, with 16 players having announced intentions to become part of a class that will likely sign a little over 20 players beginning in December. Coach Kurt Ferentz and Director of Athletics Gary Barta have both indicated they expect questions from prospective players and their parents in upcoming weeks and months. And at this point, all players who have publicly announced commitments remain committed. Still, Iowa coaches are preparing themselves to deal with questions from both players already committed to becoming Hawkeyes and those who are being recruited to address remaining needs in this year's class, as well as players from future classes who have received scholarship offers. Quote, certainly anytime your program goes through a negative situation or a challenging situation, it can potentially impact recruiting, Barta said. It's not number one on my list of concerns right now. More importantly, let's get it handled. Start putting a plan in place moving forward. Then recruiting will take care of itself, unquote. Ferentz said coaches have reached out to players committed to the Hawkeyes and to players they are recruiting, providing as many answers as possible while addressing the issues that have resulted in the situation. Quote, the main objective is to deal with things openly and assure people that we will address anything that needs to be addressed, Ferentz said. Strength and conditioning coordinator Chris Doyle, who was alleged by a number of former players to have made racially inappropriate comments or actions, was first placed on leave, then resigned last week after reaching a separation agreement with the university. An independent review of similar allegations made about several assistant coaches in the football program is ongoing and being conducted by Kansas City law firm Hughes Blackwell. Barta made it a point during an emotion-filled news conference last week to publicly apologize for what had taken place. Quote, it's to say I'm sorry to former student athletes, coaches, staff, current student athletes, anybody who had a negative experience with Iowa football, Barta said. Quote, when I say negative, if you felt mistreated, misled, discriminated against, whatever may be the case, I am truly sorry. We want everybody who participates in our program to have a great experience academically, athletically, and socially, unquote. Ferentz has found the issues raised disturbing and has expressed a willingness to correct whatever problems need to be addressed. Quote, anybody who has a bad experience in our program, anyone who leaves here without a degree, that's a failure of our program, Ferentz said. We have to be better than that, unquote. In baseball, balk in baseball coronavirus talks as negotiations drag on. The article opens with a picture of Major League Players Association Executive Director Tony Clark answering questions at a news conference in Phoenix. And the picture was taken in 2017. New York. An email from Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred to Union Head Tony Clark led to a balk in the drawn-out talks to start the pandemic-delayed season. The Executive Committee of the Players Association was set to vote and reject Major League Baseball's last offer for a 60-game season on Sunday. Players want 70 games and $275 million more than teams are offering. They are worried that if a resurgence of the new coronavirus cases causes the 2020 season to be cut short, the deal being negotiated would lock in innovations for 2021 and lessen the union's bargaining power. Manfred wrote that if fewer than agreed upon number of games are played this year, the 2021 changes would be voided in a manner that would leave them up for renegotiation. People familiar with the email told the Associated Press. The people spoke on condition of anonymity because no statements were authorized. Players didn't take a vote and will consider their next move. Among the items in the proposed deal for 2020 and 2021 are expanded playoffs, use of the designated hitter in games involving National League teams, and allowing advertisements on uniforms. The 2020 only items include starting extra innings with runner on second and a discussion of whether to allow tie games after a specified total of innings plus player re-entry in extra innings. Some players would prefer there not be a deal and that the Manfred unilaterally order the schedule. Because players have insisted on full prorated pay, he has threatened a schedule of about 50 games. The proposed deal would give Manfred the right to suspend or cancel play if restrictions on travel throughout the United States are imposed, or if he determines after consulting medical experts and the union that there has been a change in circumstances posing an unreasonable health and safety risk to players or staff to stage those games, even without fans in attendance. MLB's proposal for 60 games includes $1.48 million in salary plus a $25 million postseason players pool, while the union's plan includes a $1.73 million in salary and $50 million in the pool. Absent an agreement, the union would file a grievance claiming MLB violated the provisions in the March 26 agreement, recognizing that each of the parties shall work in good faith to, as soon as practicable, commence play and complete the fullest 2020 championship season and postseason that is economically feasible, subject to several provisions. These provisions say that without MLB's consent, the season shall not start until there are no legal restrictions on playing in front of fans, and at 30 regular season ballparks, no relevant travel restrictions, and no health or safety risk to players, staff, or spectators to playing in the 30 regular ballparks. The agreement also says the sides will discuss in good faith the economic feasibility of playing games in the absence of spectators or at appropriate substitute neutral sites. MLB had proposed having the season run from July 19 or 20 through September 27, the shortest since the 1870s, while the union agreed to start to the start date and said it should end September 30th or earlier using double headers. Both sides proposed pitchers and catchers report June 26th, followed by position players 2 days later, but they are running out of time to finalize a schedule that would allow players time to meet those dates. A rise in positive tests last week in Florida caused MLB to close all 30 training camps for deep cleaning and disinfecting. The Philadelphia Phillies announced Friday that 5 players had tested positive for COVID-19. 29 of the 30 teams now intend to hold training at their regular season stadiums rather than spring training sites. Toronto may be an exception due to Canadian federal and Ontario provincial restrictions. In golf, Simpson celebrates a Father's Day win at Harbortown. The article opens with an Associated Press photograph of Webb Simpson, Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Webb Simpson celebrated another victory on Father's Day, this time with a tartan jacket instead of a U.S. Open trophy. In a wild sprint to the finish after 3 hours storm delay, Simpson ran off 5 birdies in a 6-hole stretch on the back nine at Harbortown and closed with a 7-under-64 for a one-shot victory over Abraham Anser. Simpson won the U.S. Open at Olympic Club in 2012. The U.S. Open has been scheduled to end on Father's Day every year since 1976, but it was moved to September this year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The RBC Heritage filled the spot on the schedule, and Simpson, now a father of 5, became a winner for the second time this year with a record score at Harbortown. He didn't have much of a choice with so many low scores on a soft course with little wind. He finished at 22 under 262, breaking by 2 the tournament record set by Brian Gay in 2009. "It was a crazy day," Simpson said. I didn't get it going until 12, and then the putts started going in, and I started getting confident. It's amazing to be standing here right now. Simpson, who won the Phoenix Open in February, moved to number 5 in the world. He also moved to the top of the FedEx Cup. It was a tough runner-up finish for Anser, trying to become the 5th straight winner of the RBC Heritage to capture his first PGA Tour victory at Harbortown. He hit all 18 greens in regulation and tied for the lead with a bold fairway medal over the trees to the par 5 15th that set up a two-putt birdie. He also stayed in the game with a birdie on the 17th. Anser's shot 65. There was just no catching Simpson, whose only birdies were on the par 5s on the front 9 until he couldn't miss. He rolled the birdie putts from 10 feet and 20 feet on the 12th and 13th, two-putted for birdie on the 15th, then sealed it with two more birdies from 15 feet and 18 feet. Colonial winner Daniel Berger also stayed in the mix by chipping in for birdie on the 17th and closing with a 65. Tyrrell Hatton, whose last tournament was his victory in the Arnold Palmer Invitational, was leading until a poor tee shot led to bogey on the 13th, and bogeys were hard to recover from on this day. He shot 66 and tied for third. Dylan Fratelli had the low score of a tournament filled with them, a 62 that put him in the lead before the final groups even teed off. Justin Thomas had a 63 and tied him. Both knew it wasn't going to hold up, especially after returning from a storm delay to still conditions and even softer conditions. But it led to a carousel of contenders, and even Brooks Koepka got into the mix. Koepka hit driver on the 331-yard ninth hole that hit on the slope above the bunker and settled three feet for his eagle. He birdied the next two to get within one of the lead, but his hopes ended with a 5-foot birdie putt he missed on the par 5 15th. Koepka missed a pair of 5-foot par putts on the front 9. He closed with a 65 and finished 7th, his best result since the Tour Championship. 6 months off, 3 with the lockdown, and then 3 on my knee. So yeah, it feels like it's been a really long time since I've even felt some juices flowing, Koepka said. It just felt nice to be in contention. Rory McIlroy closed with a 70 and tied for 41st, his second straight result out of the top 30 after going 7 consecutive events worldwide with no finish worse than 5th. The PGA Tour now heads to the Connecticut for the Travelers Championship, and it's still to be determined who will be playing until coronavirus tests are released for those on the charter flight. The uncertainty stems from the first positive test, Nick Watney, on Friday, along with 11 tests for those who had been in close contact with Watney. Until the first tournament back in Colonial in Fort Worth, Texas, the area around Harbortown was crowded with the start of summer vacation. Those not on the charter will be tested upon arrival in Connecticut. Any positive test means a player must withdraw. From the religion and advice section, On Faith, upstaging Juneteenth is tone deaf, an article posted by Karis Golden. I'm concerned. I'm mad. I'm confused. Why would anyone believe President Donald Trump has been a champion of African Americans? He told Fox News, quote, "So I think I've done more for the black community than any other president. And let's take a pass on Abraham Lincoln, because he did good, although it's always questionable, you know, in other words, the end result," unquote. People agreed with him a lot more than I believed possible. I had believed Trump's comments to be hyperbole and theater, all about gaining attention in a cluttered media universe. I was wrong. I'm also concerned, mad, and confused about why anyone would condone converting doing the right thing into a contest. At best, it's disheartening to rank which president did the most for African Americans. Such gains are often couched in terms of conditions being an incremental improvement over past atrocities, if not equal treatment. In a statement last week to the Wall Street Journal, Trump said, quote, "I did something good. I made Juneteenth very famous. It's actually an important time, but nobody had ever heard of it," unquote. Trump referred to his decision to move his Tulsa, Oklahoma campaign rally after staff scheduled it to overlap with the city's Juneteenth celebration. "The act of a political hopeful upstaging a large Juneteenth event would be problematic in any election year. In our present social climate, it's tone-deaf and ill-informed at best. To do it in Tulsa, the site of the deadliest acts of terror against African Americans, is mind-boggling. Tulsa boasted one of the nation's most affluent and prosperous black communities at the turn of the 20th century. In May 1921, a white woman accused a black man of assault. This led to a group of white Tulsa residents to storm the courthouse where the man was held, followed by an armed standoff with black Tulsans. The city degenerated into chaos. Lynch mobs roamed the streets, killing black men, women, and children by hanging, burning, looting, beating, dragging, and more. The estimated death toll exceeded 300, and some bodies were never found. Whites also raised black businesses, decimating Tulsa's renowned Black Wall Street. Although black Tulsans were thwarted in regaining their former economic prominence, Juneteenth has been an important observance. Trump was noticeably mum on Tulsa's bloody past, and because, as he said, he hadn't previously heard of Juneteenth, he assumed no one else had either. To date, 47 states and the District of Columbia observed Juneteenth. The holiday's name comes from merging June and the 19th. It marks the date enslaved Texans were informed Emancipation Proclamation had ended slavery more than 2 years earlier. Admittedly, Juneteenth is not a well-known holiday, particularly outside black communities. That does not negate its importance. The holiday is born of complications of social constructs, as Ralph Ellison notes in his novel, Juneteenth. So that was it, the night of Juneteenth celebration, the celebration of gaudy illusion, unquote. Trump's recent awareness raising on behalf of Juneteenth isn't his administration's first. In 2017, 2018, and 2019, Trump issued official statements in honor of Juneteenth. At least once, his press secretary conveyed his warmest Juneteenth greetings. Never mind that, I guess. If so, perhaps we should not mind the influence that famous is based on Trump's awareness and confirmation bias. Never mind the same ignorance of social justice, politics, and history resulted in an incredulous Trump telling National Republican Congressional Committee dinner attendees, quote, "Most people don't even know Abraham Lincoln was a Republican," unquote. Turning back to the Cedar Valley section, Des Moines man killed in Bremer County crash. According to Bremer County Sheriff's Office, the deceased was identified as Douglas Martin, 75. Deputies said Martin was southbound on County Road V56, east of Redland, when his minivan ran a stop sign at the intersection of Highway 3. His vehicle struck a Chevy Trailblazer traveling westbound on Highway 3. The occupants of the SUV, Sylvester Alonzo, 49, of Olwine, and Walter Hernandez, 33, of Olwine, were transported to Mercy One Olwine Medical Center, where they were treated for minor injuries. Martin had to be extracted from the vehicle and was airlifted to Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo, where he later died from his injuries. The Orrin Fire Department, Sumner Ambulance, Redland Fire Department, Fairbank Ambulance, Air Care, and the Iowa State Patrol assisted with the accident. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, June 22nd. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa, and the first article we're going to read from the book is entitled Exploring Iowa. Located in the heart of America, Iowa is the land between two rivers, a region of the Midwest distinguished by a surprisingly rich, diverse cultural and culinary history. Between the forests of the eastern United States and the grasslands of the Great Plains to the west, Iowa's gently rolling landscape extends westward from the Mississippi River, which forms the state's entire eastern border. The Missouri River forms the western border, making Iowa the only U.S. state with two parallel rivers defining its borders. Rivers were the early highways, bringing explorers, trappers, traders, and settlers to the Iowa prairie. Centuries before the Europeans arrived, however, various Native American tribes, including the Sac, Fox, Sioux, Iowa, Meskwaki, and others, lived, hunted, and farmed across the region. The meaning of the name Iowa depends on who you ask. Traditionally, it has been described as an Iowa word, meaning the beautiful land. Although others say that Iowa itself is the French spelling of Iuawa, a name meaning sleepy ones, a name given in jest to the Iowa tribe by the Dakota Sioux. Living off the land defined the food and farming traditions of the tribes like the Iowa, whose history is carefully recreated at Living History Farms in Urbandale. Iowa farmers raised corn, beans, melons, and squash. Women did the farming in the Iowa culture, while men were responsible for hunting and making tools. Iowa families were subsistence farmers, raising just enough for their family to survive throughout the year and having a little put away in case of a bad year. The Iowa had separate summer, winter, and traveling lodges. Bark houses called nachachi kept the Iowa cool during hot summer months, while winter mat houses called chakiruta, made from layers of sewn cattail leaves, protected the Iowa from harsh winters and stayed around 50 degrees inside. While traveling on hunting expeditions, the Iowa lived in a chibothraji, or teepee, made from buffalo hides. Their villages also contained sweat lodges, food drying racks, cooking areas, work areas, hide scraping rocks, pottery pits, and gardens. at Living History Farms, historical interpreters at the 1700 Iowa farm discuss hunting, hide processing, fur trading, tool making, gardening, food processing, and the roles that Iowa men and women played in each. Interpreters use both recreated bone and stone tools and reproduced trade items to perform daily tasks. By the era of the 1700 Iowa farm depicted at Living History Farms, the first Europeans had seen the land that would become Iowa. Had history taken a different course centuries ago, Iowans might be known for their unique brand of French cuisine with a distinctly Midwestern flair. In the late 1600s, European explorers began paddling up and down the Mississippi River, passing along Iowa's eastern border. The first to visit Iowa were Frenchmen. Louis Joliet led a crew accompanied by Father Marquette, a Catholic priest. In 1673, the expedition arrived in the area that includes Pikes Peak State Park near the Iowa town of McGregor. It would be almost 150 years after Marquette and Joliet sailed along Iowa's eastern border before white settlers began moving inland to farm Iowa's incredibly rich topsoil. In the meantime, trappers and traders began exploring the rivers that fed into the mighty Mississippi. The French established some trading posts that would grow into Midwestern cities, including St. Paul, Minnesota, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and St. Louis, Missouri. In the 1780s, a young Frenchman named Julien Dubuque learned that there were rich deposits of lead ore on the west side of the Mississippi River near Prairie du Chien. Lead was valuable because it was used to make ammunition for guns and cannons. Dubuque lived among the Native Americans in the area and mined the ore. Dubuque set up lead mines near the location of the city that bears his name and lived in the area until he died in 1810. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.